Hello everyone, online and in the room today. Welcome to Eco-Socialism 2020, From Rebellion to Revolution, hosted by Green Left, with the support of the Socialist Alliance. My name is Markella Panagiris, and I'm going to be chairing this morning's session, which is titled Their COVID Crisis and Our Eco-Socialist Response. We are hosting this conference on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land. I want to pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and I extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here today and online. Sovereignty was never ceded, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. Since we are gathering today from all over Australia and also around the world, I would like to invite our Zoom attendees to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land they are on themselves in the chat. Eco-Socialism 2020 brings together a diverse range of speakers to discuss the urgent need for eco-socialism. We can now see with painful clarity how capitalism is sending humanity and the planet on a collision course towards ecocide. As Greta Thunberg said, our current system is not broken. The system is doing exactly what it's supposed and designed to be doing. It can no longer be fixed. We need a new system. Today we're going to be looking at how the current ecological crisis necessitates the demand for eco-socialism and how we can practically campaign for an alternative eco-socialist future, a collectivist society based on the global Indigenous values of egalitarianism, cooperation, and coexistence with nature.
It's my first night there.
This morning's panel, Their COVID Crisis and Our Eco-Socialist Response, will go for approximately an hour and a half. Each speaker will talk for 15 minutes, and then we'll have around 40 minutes for questions and discussion. First, a bit of quick housekeeping. For folk in the resistance bookshops in Newcastle, Parramatta, Sydney, and at the Borloo Activist Centre, toilets are close by. Please ask one of our comrades to help you if you don't know where they are. Please turn your mobiles to silent, and we also ask our Zoom attendees to put themselves on mute. Thank you.
It's only covering part of the screen.
Oh, that's the way it is.
No, it can go bigger.
I'll just ask. Just ask Zoom attendees again to please put themselves on mute, if possible. Thank you.
I can't even find that. Oh, there it is.
Okay. How did you do that?
Okay, thanks everyone. So our first speaker this morning is Peter Boyle, and Peter's going to be arguing that the alternative to capitalism must be eco-socialist. Peter is a member of the Socialist Alliance Australia, and he's a regular contributor to Green Left, and he's also a community activist. Peter radicalised around the Vietnam War, as well as race and class issues, after his family migrated to Perth from Malaysia. Peter has had a long involvement in the Aboriginal rights movement and is active in the Rojava Solidarity Campaign. He has been involved in many campaigns of international solidarity, workers' rights, democratic rights, and defence of the environment. He is still involved in building solidarity with the democracy struggle in Malaysia. Most recently, Peter has been instrumental in developing Green Left's Eco-Socialist Manifesto. When you're ready, Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter Boyle, and I'm speaking from the land of the Gadigal people alongside Markella here, and I'd like to acknowledge elders past and present, recognise this is Aboriginal, always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Now, as you heard, Green Left has recently, and you may have seen it if you're reading it, published a draft eco-socialist manifesto, And our objective is to use this to try and engage with what we see as a growing public discussion about the need for system change. we are encountering this discussion in our workplaces, in places of study, in media, old and new, and of course in the streets, especially in the mass demonstrations that we have seen in the last couple of years. Not just the demonstrations which directly address the climate emergency, such as the high school strike and Extinction Rebellion, but also in the huge demonstrations that we had here in Australia in response to the extraordinary and frightening bushfire crisis that lasted from last November to February this year, and probably are going to come back to Australia very soon. But it was also seen in other protests, I think, this anti-system message. It came through very strongly in the Black Lives Matter mobilizations, which were really big in a number of cities in Australia, partly inspired by what was going on in the United States, but of course lifting up and pushing on to a higher level the campaign against Aboriginal deaths in custody, which has been a big sore issue in this country. Whether we saw it on handmade signs that people were carrying, particularly young people, I would say, or encountered it in conversations, there were people acknowledging that the problem wasn't just the result of bad decisions of particular governments, political parties, or the actions of individuals, but problems of the capitalist system itself. The enemy was named. The C word was used over and over again. And I think that's just a fact. That has happened, and it demands a response from socialists, from eco-socialists. So this discussion, first of all, we recognize this big public discussion isn't a result of some super successful propaganda or agitation effort by organized eco-socialists or socialist organizations, but rather a spontaneous response to developments in capitalism. Basically, I think the capitalist system itself is forcing this discussion on society because it has concentrated so much wealth, economic power in the hands of so few. And because this power is now brazenly being used to put their profits above and beyond everything else, including the very livability of the planet. Well, the flip side of this is that the defenders of the capitalist system are increasingly sounding off the planet. I mean, if you switch on in Australia, Sky After Dark, that's one example. If you listen to Fox News, that's another example. If you read, if you have the stomach to read Donald Trump's Twitter rants, what the fuck? That's what rational people are thinking. Lots of rational people are thinking now. Trump has played a big role in this process, I think, because after all, the US is the belly of the capitalist beast, and its president is this raving, ranting, climate change denying, racist, misogynist, and psychopathic billionaire. You couldn't imagine a better negative advertisement for a bankrupt social system. But of course, Trump is just an expression of the bankruptcy of capitalism. Okay, that's the happy part. Maybe it's true that there's this growing questioning of the capitalist system, a dissatisfaction with the system. But where is the public discussion at about what to replace capitalism with? On that question, I think we have to admit the discussion is still in the very early stages. We, as eco-socialists, argue that capitalism needs to be replaced by a system, by an eco-socialist system, but we also have to acknowledge that we have a big job ahead of us to explain, first, what that means, and two, let alone that it is or should be the alternative. In the draft Eco-Socialist Manifesto, we argue that the necessary alternative to capitalism is eco-socialism because capitalism has left humanity with very little other choice and less than a decade to take the radical action that's needed to avert catastrophic climate change. And if anyone has been following the Twitter, they would have seen that on October 21, Adam Bandt, leader of the Greens here, put out a tweet which was reporting from a Senate's estimate committee in Parliament in Australia, where the chief of the Bureau of Meteorology, Andrew Johnson, under questioning from a senator, from one of the Green senators, I remember who it was now, said that Australia was on track to 4.4 degree rise in temperature by the end of the decade. If, you know, on if the medium projection, an international projection, on the basis of countries carrying out their promise emission targets were met, if they were met, and that's a big if, the whole world's, according to their projections, the whole world's temperature increase by the end of the century was going to be 3.4, but because of the peculiarities of Australia, that would translate into 4.4 degrees. As Adam Band said, that would signal the end of civilization as we know it. So just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. The concentration of ownership and of critical human resources and social resources is now monopolized by 2,095 billionaires. That's Forbes' calculation of how many billionaires there are around the world. And it's abundantly clear that this billionaire class overwhelmingly is blocking the action that's urgently needed to break from fossil fuels, to break the colossal production of toxic waste, and to halt the extinction crisis. And so we argue in the manifesto, one, that the political dictatorship, if you like, of this billionaire class needs to be broken. That's a political necessity to get anything done. Two, then a program of public works, huge public works, costing a lot of money, has to be undertaken in order to make the urgent shifts to address both ecological crisis as well as social needs and social justice. And ultimately, this will mean a radical socialization of the critical resources currently monopolized by that billionaire class. So in simple terms, what this means is that radical eco-socialist action now presents itself to the general public, not just as some ideological preference of eco-socialists or socialists, but rather urgent, practical, and global necessity. Now, I think another thing which is interesting, and Greta Thunberg has alluded to this, because the world has gone through the COVID-19 pandemic, the world has been given a major reminder of what an emergency means. And even some outright capitalist governments have been forced to take actions that they would never have contemplated before because, to some degree or another, they make inroads into the presumed rights of that billionaire class to run things the way that they wanted to. Our draft eco-socialist manifesto argues, history teaches us that people's political consciousness can develop rapidly in the process of sustained collective struggle, and that such movements will act as schools of direct democracy. They can also give birth to new institutions of popular democracy. And therefore, it is of critical importance to build mass movements around programs of immediate and transitional measures that the climate emergency demands. It says that the radical Green New Deal programs, championed, for instance, by former British Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders and the US Green Party, and in Australia, currently, the Greens under Adam Band, are example of the sort of programs that could be take the movement forward. However, the draft manifesto also says the system change potential of any such Green New Deal or transitional program can only be realized by an independent mass movement that is prepared to go beyond the limits of electoral campaigns. So that's the argument we've put forward. The next question I want to touch on is this question, which is maybe it's a bit more of a theoretical question, if you like, but I think it's a real question. Has capitalism reached its use-by date? Well, the push for system change, I've argued before, is driven by the contradictions in the existing system. But what stage are these contradictions at? Nearly 62 years ago, Karl Marx made this observation in his preface to a contribution to a critique of political economy. It's basically the document that sketched out the argument that he would later develop in Capital. At a certain stage of development, he wrote, the material productive forces of society come into conflict with the existing relations of production. From forms of development of those productive forces, these relations turn into fetters. Thus, then begins an era of social revolution. Well, are we there yet, is the question. Today, we can see nominally democratic capitalist governments have been turned into brazen kleptocracies as the biggest capitalist corporations actually seek to escape the limits of private property to ensure their profits. Let me give you an example. In Australia, where the mining industry, much of it exporting fossil fuels, coal and gas, is, and the deeply entwined banking sector, are some of the biggest recipients of a huge degree of corporate welfare. Their CEOs have a bigger say in running government than the parliament, let alone the people. And every single major capitalist venture today involves the systematic pillaging of the public purse through direct government subsidies, privatizations, and or tax concessions. Every infrastructure plan that you can see, big infrastructure plan being carried out now, is based on publicly subsidized and even guaranteed private profit. All this at the expense of increasing public and household debt. But Marx also noted in that same preface, no social order is ever destroyed before all the productive forces for which it is sufficient to have been developed and new have developed and new superior relations of production never replace the older ones before the material conditions for their existence have matured within the framework of the old society. Has capitalism reached that stage? Well, if the development of productive forces is fairly measured by GDP growth, then despite the global recession that COVID-19 pandemic has brought forward, and the COVID-19 pandemic itself, you know, a result of capitalism's chronic rifts with nature, which I won't go into detail here, but we can go into questioning, well, then the answer would have to be no. Because there's an army of IMF, World Bank, and OECD economists, among others, who can quite confidently predict, despite the situation, a return to global GDP growth. But in this stage of capitalism, is increasing GDP productive development? Well, writers like Naomi Klein, like Mike Davis, John Bellamy Foster, Jason Hickel, among others, have explained that much of this GDP growth now is destructive rather than productive. As Bellamy Foster says in an interview we ran in Green Left, ours is a waste-based economy built into the very structure of monopoly capitalism. We are very efficient, he's talking about the United States, at producing or outsourcing products like plastic straws, which are so cheap that we use them in a drink for a few minutes, then throw them away where they don't decompose and they end up in the oceans ingested by fish, after which others have to be produced, which can be used for a few more minutes and discarded. We consume hundreds of millions of plastic straws a day. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year in the United States on marketing. And much of this marketing is considered a cost of production. But it's all about selling things, getting people to buy things they don't need or they don't really want. So the capitalist system isn't efficient after all. Taking all this into consideration, it is incredibly wasteful, by far the most wasteful system in history, and it's accompanied by abysmal poverty for many people. Mike Davis has explained how, and I think this is a great example, particularly in the light of COVID, the big pharmaceutical companies have long been holding back research and development of the new antibiotics and antivirals. Mike Davis says, of the 18 largest pharmaceutical companies, 15 have totally abandoned the field. Heart medicines, addictive tranquilizers, and treatments for male impotence are profit leaders, not the defenses against hospital infections, emerging disease, traditional tropical killers. And a universal vaccine for influenza has been a possibility, he writes, for decades, but never a profitable priority. So there you go. It's Viagra rather than cures for the illnesses that kill millions of people. So in conclusion, About 12,000 years ago, human societies were forced by climate change. It wasn't human-induced climate change then, but it was nevertheless climate change, to begin the shift to settle agriculture. Some 6,000 years later, some of those first societies that shifted to settle agriculture began to evolve into the first class divided societies in human history, breaking from a millennial tradition, human tradition, of living collectively and in a sustainable relationship with nature. And ever since then, those class divided societies have been waging a ruthless war on indigenous communities trying to hold on to the older collectivist tradition. And that war has continued right up until this day. When the first societies were forced to make the switch to settle agriculture, remember, they used the discoveries and technologies that had been developed over the course of the thousands of years of social practice before. And you only need, in Australia, people who have read Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe to be reminded of that reality. So eco-socialism, I would argue, is a return to a form of social organization based on the two indigenous fundamental principles of collectivism and living in harmony of nature, with nature, however, with the benefit of modern technology and science. A successful eco-socialism would have to be based on direct democracy and embrace the diversity if it's not to lapse back into the old class-divided capitalist society. I think in broad terms, this is the modern experience of the horrible transformations in Russia and China. And we can also see that every single living revolution today has had to pioneer new institutions of direct democracy simply to move forward. The current impasse that capitalism has reached means that such a reversion risks human survival. So there's no doubt that building new institutions of effective direct democracy is a creative challenge for humans, for human society. However, we can learn from the collective traditions which humanity once shared, the long collective tradition that humanity once shared, but as well from more recent experiences of attempts at popular and revolutionary democracy, from the heroic, if short-lived, Paris Commune of 1871 to the exciting democratic confederalist experiment now being carried out in the Rojava Revolution in northern Syria. Okay, comrades, the draft Eco-Socialist Manifesto is just one contribution to a very big discussion, and we hope it will provoke debate, and we hope that we'll be able to develop further through a collective sharing of experiences across all borders. And this conference, and we hope there will be several other regional conferences, eco-socialism conferences that we'll put on, is part of this process. Thank you.